Think of what two victories in a row would do to America's arrogance and to its appetite for further wars of imperial aggression. In Afghanistan, Obama has to figure out how to withdraw American troops in a way that avoids both American victory and Taliban victory. While Obama may view the Taliban as a resistor against American imperialism, it's obvious he would have no sympathy for the kind of regime they are intent on reestablishing in Afghanistan. So Obama seems to be after a kind of compromise. The administration has already suggested that it may be open to a negotiated settlement so that the Taliban can share power with the current regime. Still, Obama knows he can't appear to be openly pursuing an agreement that permits a substantial Taliban role in Afghanistan's future. As we saw in an earlier chapter, Obama limited his options in Afghanistan by portraying Afghanistan as a good war, while depicting Iraq as a bad war. Obama insisted that we should get out of Iraq so we can focus on the real threat in Afghanistan. As Obama put it, Iraq was peripheral, but Afghanistan was the nation responsible for the 9/11 attacks. A little scrutiny, however, will expose the fatuity of this argument. How many of those involved in 9/11 actually came from Afghanistan? Not one. 9/11 was primarily a Saudi operation, organized by a Saudi, bin Laden, and an Egyptian, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and carried out by a Pakistani, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and a group of hijackers mostly made up of Saudis. The membership of al-Qaeda is mostly Saudi and Egyptian, so Islamic terrorism is primarily a Middle Eastern operation. Afghanistan only came into the picture because the Taliban contacted bin Laden and offered him free use of the monkey bars. While Afghanistan was indeed the launching pad of 9/11, the toxic fumes of Islamic terrorism are far more concentrated in the Middle East. Again, none of this seems to matter to Obama. His arguments function as a squid-like cloud of rhetoric, aimed at blinding people from seeing what's actually going on. If you want to know what Obama really thinks about Afghanistan, listen to this off-the-cuff statement he made during the presidential campaign. He said America should divert its resources from Iraq to Afghanistan so that we're not just air raiding villages and killing civilians, which is causing enormous problems there. What? Is that what America has been doing in Afghanistan? Not in the least. The raids have been aimed at terrorist targets, and the military goes to great efforts to minimize collateral damage to civilians. No American leader, not even during Vietnam, has described the foreign policy of his own country in such a harsh manner. And note that Obama is not talking about Iraq, a war he opposes, but about Afghanistan, a war he supposedly supports. Let's focus on what Obama has actually done in Afghanistan. Having contrasted the war of necessity in Afghanistan with the war of choice in Iraq, Obama was, from the outset, stuck with Afghanistan. How, now, to switch paths and get out? Obama's difficulty was heightened when the enterprising General Stanley McChrystal proposed his own troop surge to turn things around and win the war. Oh no, Obama was not looking for a way to win. Yet it would look really bad for him to throw out his top general's victory strategy. Obama didn't give McChrystal everything he wanted, but he did agree to send 30,000 additional troops. At the same time he announced this surge, Obama pledged a U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan starting in 12 months. As David Gergen summarized the logic of Obama's policy, the cavalry is coming, but not for long. The reason Obama's withdrawal announcement was so damaging is that the McChrystal strategy relied on building the confidence of the Afghan people that they could count on the U.S. military to protect them and to restore normality to their lives. Obviously, this whole approach is undercut if it has a one-year expiration date. So Obama had figured out a very clever stance. He would seem to be giving victory a chance, while maximizing the chances that there would be no victory. McChrystal and the Afghan people saw the futility of Obama's strategy right away, and this was reflected in comments by Afghan President Hamid Karzai and in McChrystal's stated frustration with his commander-in-chief. Obama, however, had no interest in what McChrystal or the Afghans thought. His approach was carefully packaged for the consumption of the American media and the American people. Around the same time, the Obama administration intensified its campaign to undermine the leadership of Karzai. Obama had been giving Karzai the cold shoulder from the beginning. While President Bush twice a month held a video conference with Karzai, going over in detail the situation in Afghanistan, Obama decided to stop holding those meetings. In March 2010, as Karzai prepared for a scheduled visit to the White House, he received a note from the Obama administration that his invitation was canceled. White House officials told the press they were monitoring the Karzai regime for corruption and criticized Karzai for vanity and hypersensitivity. So annoyed was Karzai by U.S. conduct that he invited Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to deliver an anti-American speech inside Kabul's presidential palace. Karzai also told members of his parliament that if this harassment and interference continued, he would join the Taliban. Now that would be a big embarrassment for Obama, to have America's key ally in Afghanistan join the Islamic radicals. So the Obama administration backtracked and brought Karzai to Washington for a fancy state dinner. Obama was less forgiving, however, when McChrystal told Rolling Stone what he really thought of the Great One. McChrystal's publicly expressed frustrations with Obama, revealing for what they show about Obama's psyche, played into Obama's hands by giving Obama a good reason to fire McChrystal. Of course, Obama had to preserve his political capital by naming a tough replacement. So he settled for Petraeus, while trusting that Petraeus won't possibly be able to figure out a way to win in Afghanistan in the time Obama has allotted him. And this provides an additional benefit for Obama. If America is defeated, he can hang defeat on America's most respected general, discredit the idea of surges, and thus further discourage American neo-colonial wars. In the White House, Obama is probably even now formulating what he can say next year. We tried. We really tried. But unfortunately, there's a limit to what American power can do in these faraway countries. I wish my misguided predecessor had realized this. He is the one responsible for this failure, and for the Americans who have died in Afghanistan. It is now time for me to finally bring the troops home. Let's learn from this and avoid these military misadventures in the future. That's how you tame a rogue elephant. This audiobook is continued on Disc 7. The Roots of Obama's Rage by Dinesh D'Souza, continued, Disc 7. Finally, I want to say a few words about the Obama administration's solicitous treatment of terrorists and Islamic militants who were captured abroad. From the anti-colonial point of view, these terrorists are simply resisting American imperialism. This does not make them virtuous individuals, but it does put them on the right side of history, at least from the anti-colonial point of view. Obama has been careful to define al-Qaeda operatives not as terrorists or enemy combatants, as President Bush did, but rather as common criminals. For conservatives, this is a classic case of political correctness, but I don't think PC has anything to do with it. Rather, Obama has a deeper, more fundamental reason for making this distinction. By defining the enemy as common criminals, Obama can separate them from the anti-colonial cause and move in good conscience to take action against them. If they were truly soldiers fighting against American imperialism, Obama's conscience would be tempted to take their side. But the evidence shows that once these bad guys have been identified, Obama has no hesitation in attacking them. As Jonathan Alter reports in The Promise, Obama in his first year ordered some 50 strikes by unmanned CIA drones against al-Qaeda targets in Pakistan. When terrorist suspects are tried and convicted in American courts, Obama is completely in favor of locking them up or even carrying out the death penalty. Obama understands his duty to protect Americans from terrorist attacks, and clearly he has no qualms about putting away people seeking to harm American citizens. Interestingly, Obama has approved special scrutiny for people coming to America from 14 Muslim countries, including Algeria, Lebanon, Libya, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Yemen. He has tried to keep this ethnic and racial profiling policy under wraps, but it shows once again that Obama's primary concerns have nothing to do with political correctness or even race. Treating al-Qaeda operatives as criminals who deserve swift and severe punishment is one thing. Holding them in military detention camps and interrogating them is quite another. Waterboarding and other forms of coercion quite likely are, to Obama, reminiscent of the tortures employed by the French in Algeria, not to mention the British in Kenya during the Mau Mau revolt. Just a few months after assuming office, Obama ordered the release of several classified memos from the Bush administration detailing terrorist interrogation methods. Predictably, the memos produced outrage in the press, because they described in some detail such procedures as sleep deprivation, keeping detainees in cold and dark cells, and in a few cases dunking the suspect underwater to give him the idea that he may be drowning. During the controversy, former Vice President Dick Cheney pointed out that the released memos were carefully redacted to leave out references to what our government learned through the methods in question. Other memos laying out specific terrorist plots that were averted apparently were not even considered for release. Obama, now in control of what information gets out and what information stays under wraps, selected the facts that would make his case. Obama has announced his intention to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay and to try terrorists like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in civilian courts. He has been forced to keep postponing the Guantanamo shutdown because, evidently, congressmen and senators are appalled at the idea of Islamic terrorists and militants being housed on U.S. territory. Obama swears that he really will close the base, but he hasn't yet determined when or how. Obama's plans for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed are also on hold. When Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder, announced plans to have this man, the leading architect of 9/11, tried in New York City, there were a host of objections. Republicans complained about the risk of giving Mohammed a global platform to air his grievances, and even Democrats worried about the cost and security issues of such a high-profile civilian trial. As of this writing, Obama is still trying to figure out how to get Mohammed out of the hands of the military. While one might expect a president to be mostly concerned with protecting the American people from terrorist attack, Obama's primary concern seems to be with protecting captured terrorists from the American military. Obama has hired several radical lawyers who have made a reputation providing free assistance to Islamic radicals and terrorists. Now these lawyers can provide those same services at the taxpayers' expense. All of this is done in the name of constitutional rights. What Obama has never explained, however, is why the rights of the U.S. Constitution extend to people who are not U.S. citizens. The Constitution, after all, is a social compact. Through mutual consent, citizens give to their government the power to protect certain rights. These rights do not extend to those who stand outside the social contract. Americans have no obligation to extend them to aliens, and they are most certainly inapplicable to those who are apprehended in foreign jihads against America. But Obama does not seem to view things in this way. One of the things that Obama learned in law school is that law can be used as an instrument of politics. And here he has chosen to make it an instrument of anti-colonial resistance, of giving jihadis the full legal protection of United States citizens. As Americans, we can only hope that Obama's narrow focus on terrorist protections doesn't increase America's vulnerability to future attacks. Already there have been close calls, such as the cases of Nigerian Umar Farouk Abdul-Muttalib, who attempted to bring down an airliner over Detroit, and Faisal Shahzad, who sought to set off car explosives in Times Square. So far, the incompetence of the terrorists has contributed to the safety of Americans. But we may not always be able to count on stupid terrorism in the future. Wishful thinking may not seem like a very effective remedy to ensure the safety of America in these dangerous times. But with Obama in the White House, this remedy may be all that we have. The United States at the dawn of the 21st century is in approximately the same position that Britain was at the dawn of the 20th. We are on top of the world, but the view is precarious from up there. The 20th century has been the American century, and with effective leadership, there is no reason America should not also dominate the 21st century. Yet there are many threats on the horizon. Britain's shining moment did not last, and the sun eventually set on the British Empire. Remarkably, America now has a president who seems to want his country to go the way of Britain, one collapsed empire following another, so that we can all recite the somber words of Kipling's recessional, "Lo, all our pomp of yesterday is one with Nineveh and Tyre." And this is indeed one option for those who are tired of American leadership in the world. But there is a second for those who are not. We can give up on America, or we can give up on this president. We are, it seems, at a time for choosing.